You're in tune with World Cricket Weekly Talk, Nigel Reid and Zubin Sakari. I know you've had half an eye, perhaps more than half an eye, on events in the Caribbean. The second test between the West Indies and Australia. Australia, of course, won the first test. And when we spoke about that, one of the good things to come out of it was the fact that both teams wanted to win the game. The second test was kind of heading in the same direction. A slightly generous declaration. Again, a positive spin in terms of test cricket. And then Mother Nature intervened and ruined the whole thing.
According to my Trini friends, more than normal rainfall this time of year. I think their June, July is their rainy season from what I hear. I think it looked like it was going to be a fairly good chase, and Sammy was on his way to trying to knock down the runs, which was good. And all credit to the Australians and Michael Clarke, obviously, for putting a sporting declaration. I think that's one of the good things about test cricket, and that's one of the things that they should be proponents of.
There was an exemplary bowling performance by one of the West Indians, but I know you have question marks about their use or lack thereof of the spinners on that particular wicket.
Yeah, I mean, if they know that, I mean, Trinidad's historically has been a fairly spin-friendly wicket, whether or not it happens on the third and fourth day, fifth day type thing, but it seemed like it was pretty dusty and tough from the beginning. And if West Indies wants to perform and do well in their conditions, and they don't have a guy like Narayan in the team or a specialist spinner, then you better, you know, try to make sure your tracks are going towards a guy like a Roach and a Fidel Edwards and getting them. You know, it's asking a lot of those guys, and not that they can't bowl well on those wickets, just it's fairly different, to something that's turning and bouncing. And obviously they brought in Shillingford, who opened the bowling and got that kind of, they obviously did that. But, I don't know if you want a wicket that's breaking up that early. You know, West Indies should be going back to the days of getting some fairly fast wickets. They have some quick bowlers in their side now, can get the ball going through and can hurry up. So why not either play the test matches where the wickets are conducive for that, or if you're going to play it in something like Trinidad, make sure you got your best spinner in the country playing.
Let's get some more perspective on this and other international matters from Faraz Sarawat, the man I call the walking encyclopedia of cricket. Writes, of course, for the Toronto Star and Crick Info and Wisden. Have you been keeping tracks of events in the Caribbean? This second test, of course, one more test to go, Faraz, and an opportunity. I'd put it no higher than that, but certainly an opportunity for the Windies to square the series.
Yeah, I think so, and they will be looking to do that. And as you mentioned, it did seem that the West Indies were kind of positive about this. There was a declaration, and then they actually did look like they were interested in chasing down this total. So I do expect them to come out in the third test looking to square the series.
Any chance of them actually doing it against, you know, a hugely competitive Australian team? Although, of course, the West Indies are the hosting team.
Well, it's going to be interesting because Australia isn't the kind of team to put the shutters down and play for a draw. So they do play attacking cricket. They do try to make things happen. And in that, they give the opposition some opportunities too. So it's not as if David Warner or Shane Watson will put the strokes away. They will come out and try to score some runs. And that gives the opposition some opportunity. On the other hand, you know, the West Indies still have to take 20 wickets. And doing that is going to be difficult for them, I think.
You heard what Zubin was saying about the selection, perhaps, of the actual pitch and then the bowler selection in terms of spinners, when, you know, traditionally West Indies would have four guys running in from the boundary and delivering thunderbolts. Is that perhaps still their best hope of getting a result and squaring the series?
Well, the West Indies would have been very heartened by the performance of Kemar Roach, the young man taking 10 wickets. Genuinely quick, not as quick as, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, but, still able to get the ball in at over 90 miles an hour, partnered by Fidel Edwards, who's also genuinely quick. So that kind of harkens back to, you know, the traditional strength of the West Indies bowling. In, you know, recent years, they have kind of given some space to spinners, still not a lot. But having said that, I mean, if you look at particularly the first innings when Australia were batting, the spinner Shillingford actually bowled 49 overs, which is significant. Next after that was Kemar Roach with 27 overs. So they are giving some space to spinners, but then the spinners have to perform also. And if it only looks like wickets are going to come through the fast bowlers, well, that's where the ball's going to go. So it doesn't matter what kind of wicket it is. It may be conducive to spin, but if the spinners aren't prizing out the wickets you need, then the ball will go to somebody who can take wickets.
Let's turn the corner here. In another corner of cricket's global village, Pakistan were making plans to host what I suppose we could describe as a mini tour by Bangladesh. It would be significant, not necessarily because of the longevity of the games themselves. I think they were going to play 2 1-day internationals, but it was to be the first bilateral series, if we can term it that, since obviously the bombings back in 2008. This week I see that tour has been postponed. I'm not sure whether it can be revived. What are your thoughts about the process? And what it says about, frankly, continuing security fears over international teams visiting Pakistan?
Well, I mean, this whole thing to me was a fiasco from the very beginning. It's understandable and highly understandable that Pakistan want international teams to come back for cricket to be revived there. I mean, there hasn't a major team hasn't come to Pakistan since 2009, since the attack on the Sri Lankan team in Lahore. And so they're making efforts to try to persuade, you know, international teams that it's safe to tour. To me, what the Bangladesh, you know, visit, and I hesitate to call it a tour because it was, you know, a visit to Lahore to play two games, an ODI and a T20 back-to-back, and then fly home. So a three-day visit to one city wasn't a tour in my view. But to, you know, to me that seemed like crumbs, and the Pakistan Cricket Board was willing to settle for crumbs. And I don't think, even if this, you know, visit had happened successfully, that it would have changed the perceptions of any of the other, you know, teams, you know, who play test cricket. So I don't think that if Bangladesh managed to play these two games that you would suddenly see the Australians touring Pakistan on a full tour. So to me, the terms of reference needed to be a lot clearer. You know, what was Pakistan really hoping to accomplish by this visit? If the idea was that, okay, we are going to gradually reintroduce international cricket to Pakistan so that the other full member countries can also come and play one or two games, and if that happened three or four times, then that opens the possibility for, you know, a larger tour. If they had said that, that to me was acceptable, and it was good to start with Bangladesh. But the idea just was that this was going to be the magic cure that was going to bring international cricket back to Pakistan, and to me that was unrealistic. Now, secondly, the fact that it didn't happen, to me, is humiliating for the Pakistan Cricket Board, that they couldn't get Bangladesh to come for two games. To me, there was always some reluctance on the part of the Bangladesh Cricket Board to even go on this tour, but their president of the board was ambitious, and it was really, in my view, just about personal gain, because he wants to be ICC president and needs the backing of Pakistan for that. And there was a bit of, you know, horse trading going on here, that I'll give you this visit, you will support my nomination, and that seems to have fallen by the wayside now. It's going to be very interesting to see how, if the PCB continues to support Mustafa Kamal for his ICC ambitions. So it was bad all around. What I think should have happened was, again, understanding that Pakistan wishes for international cricket to return, but I think it's still needs a period of a little bit more stability in order to be a little bit more convincing to other teams that they can tour. And, I think that, in Bangladesh too, they kind of jumped the gun a little bit on pulling the plug on this tour, because there was a security plan, from what I understand, a 70-page security plan that had gone to the ICC, and before that was even known to the Bangladesh Cricket Board, they pulled the plug. That's unfortunate.
Well, as you say, obviously there is some, political gains perhaps to be made in the background. But I suppose from a Pakistan point of view, sooner or later, and maybe it is still too soon, maybe it's as simple as that, maybe it is too soon, but at some stage, somebody's got to make that commitment and take those baby steps, haven't they?
Yeah, I think so. Now, one of the things is that we should, maybe lose sight of a little bit, is that domestic cricket is still happening in Pakistan. So, all of those stadiums, those wonderful stadiums that they have there, the Gaddafi Stadium in Lahore, National Stadium in Karachi, et cetera, they're all, still have cricket happening in them. And, you know, Afghanistan have come and played in Pakistan since 2009. But I guess the idea is that if there's a high-profile tour, is that something that's attractive to people who wish to harm the Pakistani state? And you know, in terms of that, I think there needs to be a little bit, it's not just up to the Pakistan Cricket Board. I think there needs to be more communication with, you know, all levels of government about what their intelligence is about things. And until that is clearer and a little bit more transparent, it's understandable that some teams might be hesitant to come to Pakistan. But I'll tell you that, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time watching cricket, and not just present-day cricket, but, you know, cricket from years ago, and I was watching some matches from the late 70s, early 80s, you know, it's quite something to see the Qaddafi Stadium in Lahore completely packed to the rafters. You know, watching Dennis Lilly come in to bowl to Majid Khan. And it's sad to think that, you know, these stadiums are largely, you know, silent in terms of watching international cricket, but they don't get to see the modern, you know, greats of the game in their own country. So that to me is sad. And I think everyone, you know, the international cricket community has a responsibility to be cooperative with the Pakistan Cricket Board. It's very easy to just turn your nose and say, well, no, we're not going to go there for security concerns. But, you know, a bit of cooperation needs to happen, and I think the Pakistan Cricket Board has a responsibility to be honest, straightforward, and transparent in what the ground realities are. And if it's clear that, you know, there is some level of threat, however minor, then it's their responsibility to not invite an international team until those threats go away.
It's going to be a work in progress, obviously, over perhaps many more years to come before that level of not just security, but comfort and confidence, I think, is restored in terms of bilateral relations. Interesting to hear what you say about, you know, those wonderful stadiums in Pakistan not being necessarily packed as they once were because of the political instability in the region. Meanwhile, across the border, of course, in India, plenty of people going to see the Indian Premier League, or so we're told, and they're putting a brave face on yet another set of figures for us, which says that, you know, despite the dancing girls and the blaring music and people getting very excited in the crowd and one or two getting their nose broken, that not so many people are watching it, and IPL 5 is on a rating slide. I mean, everybody thought after the World Cup in 2011 that was kind of mitigating circumstances for the fact that the audiences dipped for 2011 because India had just won the World Cup 5 minutes before. But here we are another year on, and the audiences, as far as domestic TV audiences in India are concerned, are continuing to slide.
Yes. Now, it's interesting that you raise the point about the audience falling a little bit after India's World Cup win. And yeah, understandable. India, as you say, won the World Cup 5 minutes ago, and here's the IPL. But, you know, IPL 5 has seen the numbers fall further. There are a few reasons, in my estimation, why this is happening. One is, obviously, the novelty factor has worn off. Cricket every day, two games every day at the dinner hour. You know, it's fine up to a point, but then at some point, oh, yeah, the cricket's on. You know, if it's on every day, then for the casual viewer, you know, the interest level can't be sustained. And really, when we're talking about something like the IPL, where you're talking massive numbers, you need more than just the ardent cricket fan watching. It needs to be something that appeals to, you know, a cross-section of TV viewership. So, you know, when something is new, it's novel, a lot of people, you know, everyone tunes in to watch it, and then the casual viewer kind of goes away after a while, and you need to constantly do something to attract them. So hence the dancing girls. But even that, you know, has a lifespan. So I think that's a part of it. The fact, I think, that, you know, the teams were blown up a little bit, and, you know, some of the players you followed on your team now play somewhere else. You know, there were wholesale changes to a lot of teams. I think that kind of detracts a little bit from what's happened in terms of viewership. It's quite possible, I mean, I'm not familiar entirely with the Indian TV schedule, but it's possible that other channels have put on programming that's competitive to draw viewers away, to draw that casual viewer away. But, I think the IPL does enough that it still has decent numbers, good numbers. you know, what can resuscitate it again? I think if they can, you know, maintain consistency in player lineups, so that builds a following for the teams. I actually think that, you know, in the next year or two, if the Pakistan players come back to the IPL, that will raise viewing numbers. I think there'll be renewed interest in the IPL just out of the curiosity of seeing the Pakistanis back. So I think there is room for the IPL to continue to grow, but the kind of oversaturation of it, I think, may leave some viewers numb, and it's just a question of too much of a good thing sometimes. You know, everybody knows Indians love cricket, but if you're ramming it down their throat, you know, every single day, and it's just a constant barrage of fours and sixes, I think that could possibly be a turnoff even for the ardent cricket fan who constantly wants to watch cricket.
Yeah, I mean, who wants entertainment? Who wants constant fours and sixes? I mean, we'd rather see people playing a proper forward defensive and another dot ball and another. I mean, of course, I'm being facetious, but I think you've got a point. I mean, I think, you know, over time, any new venture finds, you know, settles like a new house. I mean, it finds its place, Zub, and eventually it settles down and evens out, and that's where it'll be for the lifetime of the league itself.
Yeah, you have to tend to agree with Faraz too. You know, I like the consistency of the teams as one of the angles that they have to go. I mean, you want to be part of somebody who really likes Rahul Dravid, and now all of a sudden he's on the team that you didn't like last year. You're like, oh, you know, you kind of want the guy, let's take Gale. You know, Gale's your challenge, Royal Challengers guy. You know, you want him to be there. And you want him, if he gets moved next year, the guys are going to be like, oh, now I got to go support the other team. You want some affiliation and you know, recognizability of players. You know, Michael Jordan played for the Bulls. Mm. You knew that. You know, that was it. And you love that team. Yeah, and it's you know, I guess the novelty is, I wouldn't say worn off, but it's also kind of settling. Probably an accurate depiction.
And the point that Faraz makes about some point in the foreseeable future, interesting to see Mahmood, the former Pakistan all-rounder, making his IPL debut this week. And of course, his first appearance was overshadowed by Gale and de Villiers. Now, of course, he's a British citizen. But do you think there's weight to that? That, you know, once the Pakistanis are back, that'll kind of kickstart the interest and the numbers.
I totally agree. You can't have 2020 cricket without a few Stani boys in there. I mean, they're great. They're playing, a couple of guys are playing in the Big Bash League, and they've always been exciting players in that format of the game. You know, and not only that, they usually come with a bit of flair to them and long hair and you know, a bit of something behind them, which is an attractive aspect of their cricket. I mean, a guy like Afridi, who would not want to see that guy in the IPL? There's got to be some compromise or something going on. You want your best to be there, and Pakistan definitely deserves.
Faraz, as ever, a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. Get better soon, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Faraz Sarwat joining us on World Cricket Weekly Talk.